This episode of Dummy is brought to you by Who Are Ya? Check out WhoAreYaDesigns.com for the most clever soccer shirts in all the land. Whether you follow the English Premier League, MLS, or your favorite national teams, Who Are Ya has a shirt for you. Right now, they're offering free shipping to all Dummy listeners when you use promo code DUMMY at checkout. That's D-U-M-M-Y. Enter it in and you'll get free shipping on your order at WhoAreYaDesigns.com. This is
Hello and welcome to Dummy, a weekly conversation among editors and friends of Howler Magazine. My name is George Gracie. I'm the editor of Howler. Joining me from Brooklyn, New York this week, he's replacing David Goldblatt, who's on some sort of vacation, is Graham Parker. Graham is the chief soccer correspondent for Guardian US, and he writes about soccer for Grantland and ESPN. Hey, Graham, welcome.
Glad to be here.
I should also mention that you're an editor for Howler. You're working on a story for us now.
I am indeed.
Yeah, you've been with us for a long time. Okay, also joining us, a regular on the podcast, he is still the only member, unless Graham, there's something about, I don't know about you, to have scored a goal for Arsenal. He's now a scout for the Gunners, Danny Carbassian. Hey, Danny.
How's it going, George?
Yeah, I know you're in a closet somewhere. Is it South Carolina or Miami?
Back in Miami, in my own closet, so I feel at home, which is nice.
Excellent. I'm back at home as well. Memphis, Tennessee. It's the first time I've been here in like 3 months, and it feels good to be home. So that's your lineup today. We have an interesting podcast coming up. It's a lot of USA and not US national team. It's you know, MLS. It's summer tours still because we have some new things to talk about there. I want to start with the MLS All-Star game. It takes place on Wednesday. We have a skeptic's perspective on summer friendlies by another of our editors, Michael Agavino. And we talk about what makes a great soccer town. A lot of U.S. cities are claiming that these days. So we're going to talk about that. We're also joined by journalist Kanishk Tharoor to discuss why Freddie Ljungberg, Robert Pires, and a few other retired players, I don't know if there are any others from Arsenal, are heading to India this fall when they should probably be, long retired and staying that way. I don't know. We'll talk about all that. First up, the All-Star game. Bayern Munich is playing the MLS All-Stars. We want to ask a question. You know, a while ago, MLS used to play East versus West. They went to a format where they play European teams. With all these European teams coming over, is that still special enough? Should we go back to an all MLS All-Star game? What is the point of an All-Star game? Is it for the fans? Is it for the sponsors? I mean, I tend to enjoy it. I think it's one of those intersections where, you know, American sports traditions link up with our soccer league in a nice way. Graham, you've been going to All-Star games for a while now. What are your thoughts on all this?
I always really enjoy them, and I think that there's always this thing that happens, and it's the same that happens with friendly games between MLS sides and Premier League teams, which is that if the Premier League side or the European side wins, then a lot of people say, well, that's just the natural order of things. And if the MLS side wins, then people say, oh, it's an aberration. It doesn't mean anything. So, that side of it, I sort of wish in some ways it could be a little bit more of a meaningful referendum, if you like. I'd happily watch an East-West one as well, but I think it's always quite a nice occasion. And I think the other thing about them is it's such a huge territory that the league covers that this week and MLS Cup week are probably one of the two times in the year where you really get to gather the tribes. So it's as much about the social side and even the business side as anything else.
You know what I would love to see? I would love to see an American All-Star team versus a Mexican All-Star team. I think that would be really fascinating. And you want to talk about like a referendum on,
Absolutely.
I think it's clear that, you know, the rosters on Mexican teams are much deeper, but the stars on MLS teams, I think, give them a run for their money. I mean, that's, you know, we have some pretty elite players playing in this league. Danny, we always ask you for a player's perspective. I want to know what you think about, like, these guys, these players basically fly in. They're inundated with sponsor requirements and spending time and glad handing with the people who give MLS a bunch of money. And then they have to play a game, an extra game. what's in it for these guys? Like, why are they doing? Is it the recognition? Does it help them get sponsorship deals? Like, what? Why would you want to be an MLS All-Star?
I mean, I think it's exciting when any time when either fans or, you know, your peers or coaches select you as one of the best in your career, you know, wherever you are. It is a bit of a, it's a strange one, as you said. You know, I just, before I got on here, I saw Maurice Adu posted a picture of himself at the airport getting Jamba Juice. You know, he's just starting his trek out to Portland before he plays a game and then goes back in the middle of the season, which isn't the most ideal thing in the world. But yeah, as you said, it's exciting anytime a group of players that are especially meant to be the best in the league at this given time get together to play a game. It's exciting, and you get together, you know, you hash it up with guys that you might not generally get to see on a regular basis, some of your friends, and you get to play a top level game. And Bayern Munich's come into town. They won't be playing their best players. I know everybody's saying that it's going to be a U.S. Germany kind of rematch with the abundance of national team guys on both sides, but I still think it's an exciting game, and it's another chance for our players to play against some good competition and see where they stand up with them.
Okay, so Graham, take us through this All-Star roster, because I'm looking at it and we have a bunch of players who are on the U.S. team, a couple other players who played in the World Cup, not for the U.S. I'm thinking of Tim Cahill. I'm actually not sure that I see anyone else. You know, this team is composed of U.S. national teamers and then some other very good players. The U.S. national team players, though, weren't there for the last month. Do they actually deserve to be on this team, or is this sort of a marketing thing where MLS can say, look, we have some elite U.S. players on this team, and we're going to showcase them?
It's a bit of a mix of all that, isn't it? I mean, I saw that Dom Dwyer got the call up today because of the injuries, and you could say, well, on form alone, he probably deserves to be there because of the amount he's been scoring for Kansas City. You know, and at the same time, you know, you look at who's been scoring the most goals this year, it's Bradley Wright Phillips. And with all due respect to him, he's not necessarily the person who's going to sell a huge amount of tickets compared to people who maybe want to see Thierry Henry for one last time. So, there's a bit of real politic about it. There's also brand recognition that goes on as well when fans are voting for players on other teams who they might not have recognized or have seen up close and know what they're doing week in, week out. And I think the other trend that is quite interesting is the number of U.S. national team players who are now playing in MLS. And that was something that obviously came to the fore during this last World Cup. And I think also just during the last MLS preseason when, you know, I was sitting at Red Bull Arena when they did all of the interviews with all of the players, and you suddenly realize, actually, this is a movement. It isn't just Clint Dempsey coming back. It's all of these other players who've chosen to play in the domestic league. So it makes sense that they get showcased now.
One other thing that's new this year is the homegrown game. And this is where MLS gets to showcase some of it, the younger players who didn't make the All-Star game, but, you know, are deserving of recognition. And I know, Graham, you've been following the league for a while now, and you were making a good point earlier about this joining the dots between, you know, youth development and, you know, I guess a player's coming to fruition as a senior player. Can you take us through this? Like, why couldn't MLS have done this before? And what's new now? What's going on in the league that allows this to happen?
Well, I think in part it's critical mass, both of teams, of ownership, of resources, of players. I think also they've started to develop the academy systems around the league, and those are beginning to bear fruit now. And also there's various schemes going on. I mean, I think that the deal with USL Pro, where teams are partnering with USL Pro sides and being able to send players out on loan, that's another really important part of development. So all of these things happen really slowly and in a really kind of unsexy way, you know, but they're really crucial to the development of the league. And so the homegrown game, I think, is one of those sort of rare opportunities to showcase the fact that this work is being done.
So I saw earlier DeAndre Yedlin had been named to the roster and then removed because he was named to the full All-Star team. And it reminded me of, I guess it was last week, a U.S. under 23 roster came out. They're having a training camp in the Bahamas, I believe. And he wasn't on it. And I was thinking to myself, you know, there are some players who just, they leapfrog that. They become bigger than that team. Now, Yedlin's an interesting case because he hasn't actually played that much with the senior team. And I don't think that it would hurt him to be part of that team for a while, because he's still got a year or two left, right, of eligibility. With a guy like him, are we maybe expecting too much? Because, you know, we put him on the U.S. roster, right? Or I guess we shouldn't say we. Jurgen Klinsmann put him on the U.S. roster. He made some good appearances in the World Cup, but not at the position that he's been playing in MLS. I mean, Danny, just from your perspective, is he ready to take the mantle from Steve Cherundolo and be in contention for the right back spot? I mean, because I'm not sure that Fabian Johnson is the permanent replacement back there. What are your thoughts on sort of where he stands right now?
Well, can I just make one point real quick on what you said about him kind of leapfrogging the 23s? When I was at Arsenal, Thierry Henry spoke to us one day. He got the club kind of arranged essentially like almost like a Q&A where Thierry kind of told his story to the reserves and a couple of the youth guys as well that were coming through, almost like as an inspirational thing, which was fascinating, obviously, because he was at the top of his game then, and hearing a world-class striker just talk about how he kind of came up and everything was pretty awesome. But he mentioned that after France won the 98 World Cup, and he was obviously a part of that team, he got called into, I think it was maybe the 21s or the 23s for France, like 3 or 4 months later. And a couple of the guys did, actually, that were in the World Cup winning team. And he said a couple of the guys that got called in who were in that World Cup winning team didn't come into that camp with the appropriate attitude. They came in thinking they'd already made it and that everything was going to be rosy. And some of those guys probably didn't have as good of a career as Thierry ended up having. So when we talk about, you know, is he too big for the 23s and should he just go straight into the first team? I don't think ever a player can become too big for a team, especially of his country, especially when he's that age too. Because yes, Yedlin played 2 or 3 good games for the U.S. at the World Cup, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to become a world beater and slot right into the right back spot. You know, getting the opportunity to play with the under 23s against good competition and still representing your country, and then also just dominating at that. At that age group will become important. You know, these guys that come in and show their ability at the senior level, they have to be able to do it at all levels. You know, when you see a kid come into the first team at a big club, you'd like to see them be able to step into the reserves and absolutely run the show as well. So you kind of see what a player's like mentally and what he's all about as well when you drop him back down to, I guess, his respective age group.
That's a good perspective. And that's really interesting about Thierry Henry. I mean, you know, I guess the moral of the story is that if you're a great player, then you can you just boss it whenever you
get. Yeah, yeah. And I think the funny thing is when Henry got called into that camp, I think it was like in the Ukraine, like it was a under 21 World Cup or like a qualifier for the Euros, like in the Ukraine in like November or something too. So it was like freezing. And, you know, all of them were thinking, oh, what is this? We just won the World Cup with the first team. Do we really have to go to this?
Yeah, they basically sent us to Siberia.
Exactly.
Okay.
I think there's, I was just going to add that I think there's an interesting point about the development in US soccer in particular, which is about the role of the college game plays and about how, you know, for how long we sustain the idea of the, you know, the draft and that as a path and one of the main paths through to the league. And I think that what they're trying to do with the academies much, much longer term is to sort of find ways past that. And, you know, now that the players do realistically have a journey through, right the way through from 12, 13, all the way through and playing in first teams, or yes, even playing, you know, under 23 internationals or whatever, but with the, you know, the requisite level of experience of their peers around the world, rather than just starting a senior career at 22, 23.
I like that. The other thing that I noticed when I was reading this story about the homegrown game is the writer, it was on Major League Soccer's website, and the writer mentioned that Julian Green had been included in Bayern Munich's roster. So in a sense, he's a homegrown player for Bayern Munich. And we had a story in the last issue of Howler, not really a story, a small piece by Eric Beard, talking about how Julian Green could be a spearhead for Bayern coming over to this country and sort of trying to convert some new fans. And Bayern has been very active in that. They opened an office in New York City not too long ago. I just enjoy that idea that you know, he's going to get a chance to play in front of an American audience that saw him score a goal for the U.S. in the World Cup, but really doesn't know this guy at all otherwise.
Yeah, actually, I saw when Bayern played Chivas, I guess in New York this week as well, he didn't play, and a lot of fans were actually really upset about it because they wanted to see him, you know, on their own soil. But I think he'll likely get a chance against the All-Stars. I mean, if you know, we talk about marketing and sponsorships and all this sort of stuff and brand building all the time on this show. And if there's ever been a chance to build your brand, especially if you're Bayern Munich trying to come into the States and make an impact, then playing Julian Green against the MLS All-Stars is one way to do it.
It'll be interesting to see if they actually play.
I was just going to say, I think it'll be interesting as well in terms of, I almost felt like Roma didn't quite get what the All-Star game was. They just sort of came out and crushed the All-Stars. I feel like Chelsea had sort of like been over a few times. They're over every summer. They're there in the US. They know they rotate their young players. They give them, you know, they give them fitness. They probably play a little bit more of an attacking game than they're used to. So you get games with lots of goals and so on. Whereas Roma just sort of figured out the midfield and dominated throughout the game. And by halftime, it was sort of one of the more dispirited press boxes I've ever been in. So it'll be interesting to see how Bayern treat it.
Yeah, and I wonder if Julian Green plays and then he doesn't really play in the first team at all this year, it'll be interesting because, you know, it'll demonstrate a level of sort of savviness on Bayern's part in terms of the marketing that you know, will become clear, I guess, when we see whether he actually figures in Guardiola's plans or not. Okay, well, that does it for that discussion about the All-Star game. It's on Wednesday in Portland, and I'm sure we'll have something to talk about afterward. Last week, we talked about European clubs touring the U.S., and this Saturday, a friendly between Manchester United and Real Madrid in Ann Arbor, Michigan, broke the attendance record for a soccer game in this country with a crowd of 109,318 people. Howler contributor and author of The Soccer Diaries, Michael Agavino, is not a fan of these summer tours. Here's Michael.
So for me, these international summer friendlies are just kind of a waste of time. It's a great way for the clubs to kind of tap into this still new American market and bleed money out of us. But I see no use for these games. In the old days, so to speak, it was kind of a novelty if a team from Europe or South America came to the U.S. But I think that novelty wore off long ago, and now it's just a money-making scheme. And even if I'm a fan of one of these elite clubs that come here, I don't even know if I want my favorite players to be playing in 90-degree heat and 80% humidity in Texas or Florida or New York. Frankly, I think they should still be on a beach somewhere or training in the Alps. But again, as long as they make money, we'll see more of these. And in the long run, it's probably bad for the players and bad for the managers, but they probably have less and less say in the whole thing.
I've been doing the same thing ever since 1912.
We're going to pause for just a second there. I want to make a quick note to all the listeners that Who Are You Designs is a new sponsor for the podcast. They have a great line of t-shirts with a bunch of national teams, club teams. They even have one with Clint Dempsey's deuce face on it. If you head over to whoareyadesigns.com, that's whoareyadesigns.com, and use the promo code DUMMY, you can get free shipping and support our show at the same time. So go over there and check them out. The MLS All-Star Game is taking place in Portland, Oregon. We know that. It's arguably one of the capitals of American soccer culture. But, you know, Seattle and Kansas City and a few other cities have made the same claim. We're going to talk about what makes a good soccer town. Graham, you've done a fair bit of traveling around this great land to watch soccer. What for you makes a good soccer town, and what are some of the top candidates?
I think you've mentioned some of the top candidates. I think one of the things that's interesting, I had a great moment in the All-Star game last year in Kansas City, where there was a big party the night before the game, and maybe I think like 10,000 people had sort of filled this area in downtown Kansas City for a big concert. And I saw Merrick Paulson, the owner of Portland Timbers, sort of standing on a balcony, looking out over this throng and kind of looking really thoughtful and deep in thought. It was kind of like challenge accepted kind of thing for this year. So I'm interested to see how Portland steps up. I think there are towns that have great soccer history. So the Pacific Northwest, the fact that those teams continue to exist in some form or other, or you had strong college soccer programs, which sort of happened throughout the 70s, 80s, 90s, you know, right up to the MLS era, means that, you know, the Cascadia area, all of those towns are kind of interesting. I think if you went to Montreal on the day that David Beckham is playing with LA Galaxy, you would have said, oh, Montreal is a great soccer town. And then if you went the next week, you would go, maybe not so much. So certain towns are event towns. And I think the thing that all of them have in common, of the best, the ones that have best practice, are that they have ownership who have some kind of meaningful ongoing dialogue with the supporters groups. I think that Kansas City, for example, very digitally savvy, and they consulted with the supporters groups. They designed the end that's known as the cauldron at the stadium in consultation with the supporters groups in terms of what they wanted, angle of viewage, even acoustics. And that created a sense of ownership and loyalty, and they continue to sell out week after week.
Let me cut you off real quick. A lot of the characteristics you mentioned are embodied by some of these MLS teams. And I think MLS made a switch in the mid 2000s where they decided, you know, we're not going to build any more stadiums out in the suburbs, or we're going to be more careful about that. Cause obviously you could say that Kansas City did that and they've still been successful, but there's something that links up like this idea of like a new urban fan rather than a family. Danny, you know, I want to bring up Miami as well, cause Miami is a good example of a huge city that does not have an MLS team and doesn't really seem to care. I mean, you know, you have a lot of South American soccer fans who, when I was down there for the World Cup, you would go out and you would see like zillions of Colombia jerseys or Argentina jerseys. Do you actually need to have a soccer team to be a professional soccer team, to be a soccer town?
I mean, I don't think so, to be completely honest, because we saw last year, even in the International Champions Cup that happens here every summer, I guess, 65,000-70,000 people came to watch that Real Madrid-Chelsea game, and there definitely are fans here. But at the same time, when the Miami Fusion, and I know that they were based out of Fort Lauderdale when they were here, it's a little bit of a drive from here. You know, they ended up not getting the support that they needed to continue on in the league. But as you guys mentioned, you know, I've been to nearly every single MLS ground from my work as a scout, and seeing that, when you mentioned that new urban fan that's kind of come into play, it's pretty cool seeing it. You know, you get into Portland, you take a train to the stadium, and same with Seattle, you know, you walk to the stadium, everybody's chanting. It's much more I guess it's much more of a European feel than you'd expect than a traditional American soccer game, where for me, like going to watch a game in Dallas, for example, is much more of a traditional American soccer game, where you drive to the stadium, there's a bunch of families going, it's a big family outing. Whereas I'm not 100% sure I'd want my child walking in the thick of it on the way to a Seattle Sounders game when everything's kind of going off and people are covering their face because there's flares and smoke bombs going off everywhere, you know. But yeah, back to your point, I mean, Miami, huge soccer city, fans everywhere, but if they did get a team here, I'm not 100% sure that they would have that fan base that comes out to watch those big games every summer here, if they'd be turning out week in, week out to watch an MLS team.
So when a player is trying to decide, you know, what team they want to play for, if they're making a switch, I imagine you encounter this with Arsenal quite a bit. You know, you get to live in London as opposed to like some crappy ex-mining town in the north of England. How much does the atmosphere and the support...
Steady.
you definitely moved here from there, Graham, so I don't think you're...
I got nothing to say.
How much of a difference does that support and that feeling of, you know, the atmosphere created inside the stadiums, the atmosphere out in the streets when players are recognized, how much does that weigh on them when they're making that decision?
I think it does. It definitely, I can't say it would play a huge role, but it definitely plays a role. You know, when I when I was living and playing in London, you know, your life off the pitch as well. And I know you're focused, and everybody, all the fans are always saying like you should only be focused on football. But at the end of the day, they're human beings as well, and they also have to enjoy their life off the pitch. And if they're not, then it certainly reflects on their time on the pitch. So being in a city, especially like London, for me, when I moved there from tiny Roanoke, Virginia, it was nice being able to, when I was homesick, being able to find an American bar and hanging out with American people and hearing American accents, you know. And when I went to Burnley, what I found difficult was just suddenly I was in a very, very English town, and I enjoyed England and I enjoyed English culture. But being able to have the option of kind of doing whatever you want in a big city and eating whatever type of food you want, or going to a theater, for example, to see something completely non-football related, I think it does play kind of a big it can play a big role in determining where a player decides, you know, taking his future. You know, if one team has everything that London has to offer, and then there's another team coming in that's a small town of, you know, 100,000 people, but they're a very good team, maybe you go for, especially if you're married or something, maybe you go for something that'll appease your entire family and your life off the pitch as well. So it definitely does. Have an effect.
Okay, last place I want to take this, Graham, for you. You've done a bunch of traveling, and there seems to be some size element here, right? Like a huge American city might be too big, and I think this might be true, you know, for a lot of things. I mean, you go to LA, you go to New York, you go to Chicago. Those are some of our biggest cities, and they have struggled at times to support their teams, whereas Columbus has done a great job. You know, Rochester always drew well for the Rhinos. Portland and Seattle and Kansas City are not those top level, you know, in terms of population cities. What's going on with that?
I think in a smaller city, it's possibly easier to manufacture the idea that this is the scene, that, you know, that this sense that when you go there, you really are part of something, you are really activating something, that your presence matters, you know, and I think that's important for this generation of American soccer fans, or certainly the ones who are drawn to MLS. And I think that if you're in New York, you're constantly aware that there are 20 other places you could be on any given evening, no matter what you're doing. And some of that is really exciting. Some of that is what means that you can always find a critical mass of your people, if you like. But what it also means is that it's very diffused. There are 10, soon to be, you know, 11 major sports teams, and it's very hard to gather a sense of momentum or to be heard above the clamor of everything else that's going on.
Okay, it's time for another quick break, but stay right there. We are going to be back in just a minute with our next guest, journalist Kanish Tharoor, to talk about the growth of soccer in India. Okay, joining me now is Kanish Tharoor. He's a writer, and he's an Indian, and he grew up in New York City and a bunch of other places. He joins me now from New York City. Oh, he's also the global soccer editor for Roads and Kingdoms. Kanish, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, George. Great to be here.
Okay, so I want to ask you about this this new thing, the Indian Super League, because they've just signed Robert Pires and Freddie Ljungberg and a couple of other, you know, very well-known kind of aging European stars. And from what I understand, there's already an Indian league, the I-League. So what's going on here?
Right. So this Indian Super League is going to begin. It's scheduled to begin in October, and it'll last about 2.5 months, ending in December. It's administered by the same body, the AIFF, which also administers the I-League, the normal league. But the I-League is being sort of sidelined to accommodate the Indian Super League. So the I-League has been postponed till January. So just imagine the equivalent of that would be if you, say, had a sort of 2.5 month league dropped in the beginning of the English Premier League calendar, and then you suddenly postpone the entire Premier League till December.
So. Right. Okay. And so, you know, the I-League, though, has some really historic teams. I mean, there are some teams there that go back a long time.
Right. So, I mean, the I-League has a team, have teams like Mohun Bagan, a club in Calcutta, or Kolkata, as it's now called, which has been around since the 19th century. So it's where the traditional sort of institutions of Indian soccer reside, but they have been found wanting by commercial bodies and other aspects of other parts of Indian society. And so this Indian Super League has been cooked up to sort of drum up new attention and new commercial interest in soccer in India.
Okay, so there are more than 1 billion people who live in India. And yet the country is ranked 151st in the FIFA rankings. Do people in India, I mean, I know it's a big cricket country. Do people support soccer? Do they play it? What is soccer's role in sort of the psyche, the athletic sporting psyche of the country?
I would say it's probably now the second most popular team sport in India after, as what you rightly said, is cricket. But it has a huge domestic audience for soccer. But you know, like many other emerging market countries, India faces the same problem in building its own league, its own domestic game. In that, because of TV and satellite and so forth, Indian football fans, are disproportionately watching the European leagues, international tournaments, but not watching domestic soccer. I think some recent study recently suggested that less than 6% of people who watch soccer in India are watching domestic soccer.
I think I also saw that 40% of soccer viewers, I guess, on TV are women. Is that true?
I wouldn't be surprised if that's true. In India, if you go to cricket matches, you see lots and lots of women in the audience, and Indian women are as passionate about their sports as Indian men are.
And so you wrote about Messi's visit to India last year. It seems like Indians are clamoring for international soccer. Does the country need its own league, or at least a successful league, in order for soccer to become, you know, a giant thing there, even bigger than it is now?
Well, so the paradox is that India is incredibly important to a lot of the sort of authorities and commercial bodies that run soccer in the world. They are interested in India as a commercial market. So, you know, for India to grow as a market for soccer, you don't necessarily need a strong functioning local league. But I would argue that for India to grow as a footballing force in the world, you do need a functioning league with a proper calendar, with teams that have developed academies that bring players through. And what one of the criticisms of the Indian Super League is that it's going to be sucking away attention and resources from that sort of much more difficult project, and just producing a 2.5 month commercial spectacle that will generate money.
Right, and not really include Indians, maybe, right?
Well, technically, 14. So there are 8 franchises. And it should be mentioned that these are franchises. These aren't clubs.
Right.
So in many ways, what's being done here is the opposite of the traditional model of the way soccer developed around the world. So each of these franchises has to have 14 out of 22 players who are Indian. And each of them will have one marquee player. So as you said, there's David Trezeguet, Freddy Ljungberg, Robert Pires. I'm an Arsenal fan, so I'm kind of... You know, the prospect of seeing them play in India is kind of amusing and surreal for me. And others will be there. They've also brought in a few journeyman Italians and African players from lower leagues in Europe. But then the rest of the squads will be put together with Indian players.
And who's investing in this?
So the league has been launched by a joint venture by the International Management Group, which, as you know, is a huge sports media empire based in the US, and Reliance, which is another conglomerate company in India that does everything from retail to pharmaceutical to petrochemicals to oil and gas extraction. They're providing the sort of commercial backing, a muscle behind the whole project.
And so clearly they think that soccer is going to be a big thing.
And they're correct in thinking that there is scope and potential to invest in a tournament like this. But I do think that, you know, on the plus side, this is the ISL will be great for many Indian national team players, who will get more money, because the pay in India, the Indian League, while it's getting better, isn't that great compared to other leagues around Asia, let alone the world. And B, we'll have the experience of playing with top class European and international talent, albeit that these players are over the hill. But it's unclear to what extent this 2.5 month long tournament can in a meaningful way contribute to the improvement of facilities and infrastructure on a more permanent basis around the world of Indian football.
So is there any talk about merging the two main entities, the I-League and the Super League?
Yes, there is, though people are not sure how that will look, because I think the understanding has already been reached that it's a little bit unsustainable to have to try to balance these two leagues as separate entities, because the ISL completely undermines the I-League. But it's unclear how that merger will happen, and people have sort of sketched a sort of 5 to 6 year timeline for that merger. But it's unclear, again, what that would look like.
So one of the big catalysts, as you know, for soccer in the United States is the World Cup and the U.S. team's participation in every World Cup. Now, I assume that India would really benefit, Indian soccer would really benefit from the Indian national team's participation in a World Cup. What are the prospects for seeing an Indian team in the World Cup in the future?
Very, very slim. What you will see, though, is that FIFA has granted India the rights to host the FIFA Under 17 World Cup in 2017, which will be, and India will participate in that tournament. And the rationale behind that, at least from FIFA's part, is that this is a sort of a test to see whether India, I think, down the road will have the capacity to host the World Cup. The full World Cup in earnest.
Oh man, I would so be at a World Cup in India. That would be so amazing.
Yeah, and I think Indians all right now are of the opinion that the only way the Indian national team will qualify for a World Cup is if they're given a chance to host it.
Yeah, I mean that's true for a lot of countries. But man, I hope it happens. Okay, Kanishk, I really want to thank you for coming on to Dummy. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you, George.
Okay, it's about time to wrap things up. Before we do, let's do our Tiki Talka segment, where we each bring up one thing from the soccer culture in the last week that we loved. There are a couple of really great candidates this week. Danny, I'm going to let you go first because I know I want to wait. I'm feeling really good about mine, so I'm going to let the suspense play out a little bit.
Okay, I was just going to make a quick reference to BT Sport have been kind of releasing a bunch of adverts in the lead up to the new Premier League season, and they picked on Arsenal, I think a couple times actually. One with the Liverpool's 5-1 win at Anfield, and then I think also Chelsea's 6-0 at Stamford Bridge. And they show these epic commercials saying all the drama on BT Sport or whatever, which actually I guess pissed off a bunch of Arsenal fans, and a couple Arsenal fans publicly canceled their BT Sport subscriptions based off these things. So I just thought it was kind of funny. I think an Arsenal fan created a alternative BT Sport advertisement, highlighting Liverpool's title slip up basically, and it went viral the other day. And I just thought it was funny how I saw it was actually kind of not offense. I mean, I'm an Arsenal fan and love the club through and through. But seeing them advertising the 6-0 is all the drama, or the 5-1 is all the drama, was kind of heartbreaking. So seeing this alternative commercial, I thought was really, really funny.
Excellent. Okay, Graham, how about you? What do you have this week?
Well, I think that this is one that maybe Danny would appreciate because he's already mentioned Thierry Henry. But watching Henry this last week, I mean, both playing against Arsenal last week and then in midweek, just sort of stroking the ball into the net as lazily as you'd like against Real Salt Lake. And Gerard Houllier, who's the Red Bulls and global director of soccer, I'm not sure exactly what the title is, but he was caught by a reporter last week and he was asked, did he think that Henry was going to call it a day this year at the end of his contract? And he seemed to suggest that he probably would. So it's just about a little bit of a nod to sort of one of the all-time greats who we may be seeing the last few months of on a field. And there are still, he hasn't got the pace anymore, but his touch is still sublime when he chooses to be. He's one of my favorite players to watch in MLS, partly because he really does play up the pantomime diva to the full extent as well. He's kind of like he can be like a wrestling heel at times, but still capable of some of the finest touches you will see on a field. So it was great to see him score that goal in midweek.
Excellent. Okay. Did you guys see Megan Rapinoe's goal, by the way?
Yeah.
Yeah, I did.
Oh,
yeah.
My God. Yeah. Did she mean it? Anyone see if anyone asked her if she meant it?
Everyone means it.
Okay. My Tiki Talker this week is totally self-promoting, but I got to tell you, it's something I've been trying to do for a long time since I was a little kid. Do you guys play FIFA, the video game? FIFA?
Yeah.
Yep.
You ever try to score with your goalkeeper? Like,
yes.
Like dribble the entire team? Did it ever work? Do you ever do it?
I've done it once.
Oh man.
So but against like an 8-year-old, so right. It wasn't particularly
okay,
that
well,
exciting.
Well, so I just joined your club because I scored with Donovan Ricketts against Liverpool. And by the way, this is FIFA 15. I was playing like an early build, but they hadn't programmed in that Suarez was no longer there. So Suarez was playing. Ricketts went by the entire Liverpool team and scored a goal. I felt really, really good about myself. I mean, I got to say, I thought that FIFA had programmed the game so that you couldn't score with the goalkeeper. I was so convinced that it was impossible because I've tried so many times. I've pissed off so many friends by breaking the game and basically just trying to do this. And they would score four goals while, in the meantime, and I would just lose. But this made like all of those failed efforts totally worth it. It felt great.
So happy for you.
Here's the thing, though. We actually, we sent a listener to this event in New York. We did it for Seattle, New York, and we're going to do it next week in Portland through EA Sports, who, they actually advertise in the bulletin. And I was actually playing this guy, this really nice guy named Sam from West Virginia, who we had sent to this thing. And then I did this to him and I felt like a huge jerk because then I had to like videotape it 8 times. And, I just couldn't, I had to show people who were walking by. I felt so good about myself. And then I was like, man, we probably just lost a reader, but Sam, if you're listening, I'm sorry, but you're the man. Okay, guys, I think that does it for this week. I want to thank our guest, Kanishk Tharoor, for joining us on the show. Thanks to our panel, Graham Parker in for David Goldblatt this week and Danny Carbassian. The Howler Singers are led by Lindsay Elliott. They are members of the choral ensemble Ghostlight, and they made our theme tune. All the rest of the music is by Brian Kim. Make sure you subscribe to our podcast in iTunes. Just search for Howler Radio if you haven't yet. And you can also get us in any other podcast app that you use. We're also on Twitter and Instagram at WhatAHowler. This podcast was produced by Matthew Nelson. He says in the notes he's given me that he will give me $5 to say that he is the only producer of this podcast to have scored a hat trick for his co-ed team. I guess that's true. And he had help from Ryan Katniss, Kira Deppenbrock, and Milena Barajas. My name is George Gracie. I'll be back next week with all the rest of these dummies. David Goldblatt will be back with us. And we'll see you then. But before we leave, this week we met one of the winners of our EA Sports contest. As I just told you, he's a massive Liverpool fan, father of four, all-around great guy. Sam Smith was out in New York for EA Sports to play the forthcoming FIFA 15 game and attend the Manchester City-Liverpool match at Yankee Stadium. We'll be using his audio for an upcoming episode of Howler Radio, but here is a little taste of what we recorded. Take it away, Sam.
Not Lucas. Oh, my goodness. Okay. Lucas.
He's Brazilian. He's an EU.
All right.
No pressure. No pressure. Shout out.
That's one in.
Where's David Luiz now?
That's one in for Man City.
Finish.
And two in for Liverpool. Lucas Leiva steps up to win it for the Liverpool Reds, the Red Men. Could this be Lucas' final act? Here it comes. In! Yes! Liverpool wins! Liverpool wins! Yes!
They look very excited to win.
on to Miami.
Look how excited they were.
Oh, this was a great game. This was a wonderful game. We loved it.
This episode of Dummy is brought to you by Who Are Ya? Check out WhoAreYaDesigns.com for the most clever soccer shirts in all the land. Whether you follow the English Premier League, MLS, or your favorite national teams, Who Are Ya has a shirt for you. Right now, they're offering free shipping to all Dummy listeners when you use promo code DUMMY at checkout. That's D-U-M-M-Y. Enter it in and you'll get free shipping on your order at WhoAreYaDesigns.com.